I'm Bob Main, and the reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. Welcome to episode number 285 of your weekly Handgun World podcast. Well, I'm your host. I'm just a regular guy, folks. I'm not a gunsmith or ex-law enforcement or ex-military. I do some firearms training on the side, but my background is just being a regular dude. Hey, I'm a salesman. You know, I'm one of the most hated people on the earth, right? I sell stuff. Yeah, I've been doing it for a long time, 28 years. I'm a Yankee with a gun, born in New York City, raised in Wisconsin, but now I live in the great gun-friendly state of Texas, San Antonio. Matter of fact, home of the NBA champion, San Antonio Spurs. That's where I live right now. So, anyway, this episode number 285, I'm going to speak a little bit about using reloaded ammunition again, because last week's podcast was about that, and I have some more information for you as far as whether you should be or should not be using reloaded ammunition for your self-defense needs. I don't think you should be, and in one of the segments in this episode, I am going to talk about that. I've got an interview coming up right now. I got an interview coming up a little bit later in the show as well, and I will kick that off when the time comes. I'm in the Handgun World mobile studio, folks, cruising down Interstate 10 in my Honda, as usual. My paid-for Honda, because I can't stand car payments. Car payments. Man, I tell you what, is there a worse investment that you could possibly make than throwing money down the drain on a vehicle? Hey, we all like new cars, but you know what? The practical side of me, the frugal side of me, says that cars really basically do nothing but lose money. There are a few exceptions, but they lose money. So, you know what? I drive paid-for cars, and they may not be pretty, but they work, and they run, and they get good gas mileage, and Hondas just run and run and run and run. And when you log as many miles on the road as I do, that's, you know, that's what you want. So, anyway, this podcast is about guns, not cars. I want to talk a little bit right now about California. So, here's a shout-out to all California listeners. Guess what? I'm going to Northern California to the San Joaquin Gun Club, not very far from Stockton, I believe, to teach a class, Beyond Concealed Carry. I'm going to do it myself. Ben cannot make the trip with me. But Scott is, a listener named Scott is the host. He's also an instructor, and he teaches a lot at that range. He's going to be hosting me. I'm going to be teaching our signature class, Beyond Concealed Carry. Now, I know some of you are thinking, but Bob, we can't carry much in California. I know. I get that. But you also need to know how to handle your gun for defensive purposes in case you use it inside of your home and all of the other different ways that you could possibly be defending yourself. Or if you just want to become a better shooter. You know, maybe shooting is one of your passions, like it is mine. Maybe it's not your full-time thing, but it's one of your passions. And you just want to learn to get better with your handgun. Come to Beyond Concealed Carry. It's a one-day class on October 18th, Saturday, October 18th in Northern California. San Joaquin Gun Club. Look it up. Okay? Saturday, October 18th. We'll start about 8:30. We'll finish up about 5:30. Beyond Concealed Carry. Your investment includes a barbecue lunch at the range. How cool is that? That's pretty cool. It includes lunch for the investment. Just go to handgunworld.com. There's a class sign-up page that I've already set up at handgunworld.com, my website, and you'll see that right there. You'll see Beyond Concealed Carry California. Go ahead and get signed up for that if you want to register. And it's going to be a great time for all. I understand that there are several people. Sign-ups have already begun. Scott's taking care of some of those, but I would much prefer, if you are listening to this show, that you go directly to my website at handgunworld.com and get signed up for that. Now, I want to speak a little bit about the practical side of handgun ownership for a minute. The practical side. And here's what I mean by that. Recently, I listened to the Road Gunner podcast where they had Tate versus Hadaway, and it was pretty funny stuff. Explicit stuff, but pretty funny stuff. But John Hadaway talked about his probable versus possible scenarios when they were talking a little bit about prepping. And, you know, John's been on this show many times, and he's talked about possible versus probable. Let's apply that to handgun ownership, shall we? Let's do that. How many of you found yourself thinking when you buy a handgun and you prepare to carry it, how many of you find yourself thinking, what's possibly going to happen or what's possibly going to happen? So I that's the way I felt. When I first started carrying a gun back in 2005, I think I got my license in 2006. I started shooting in 2005, actively shooting, got my concealed handgun license in 2006, is when I got my first one. Anyway, I thought to myself, wow, Bob, you know, what could possibly happen and what's probably going to happen? Now, we all know that the statistics. We all know that the actual odds of you having to use your handgun for self-defense is pretty slim. A lot of other things can happen to you. I mean, look at me, right? I'm fighting cancer. Excuse me, voice crack. I'm fighting cancer. It's going pretty well, by the way. It's going pretty well. I'm making very, very good progress. The doctors are pleased. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that my next chemotherapy treatment coming up in about a couple weeks, I'm keeping my fingers crossed that that's going to be my last one, that they can declare me cancer-free and then just monitor me. But, you know, I'm fighting non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and my wife has a serious illness that she's battling, a life-threatening illness. So that's more probable. It's more probable that you could get sick. It's more probable that your power could go out for a couple of days or 3 days or 5 days. Okay? It's more probable that you might lose your job. It's a lot of things are a lot more probable than you having to use your handgun. But this is a gun show, and this is what we talk about. So now let's assume that that bad day comes that you have to use your handgun in self-defense. And I've probably said this hundreds of times on this show. We don't go looking for trouble, but sometimes trouble finds us. And are you going to be ready for it? Well, what's probable and what's possible? So let's get practical here for a minute. If you have to use your handgun, what's possible? Well, it is possible that you could get attacked by 15 ninjas all carrying AR-15s. That's possible. Is that probable? I don't think so. I think what's probable is you're going to get attacked by some street thugs. One of them, two of them, maybe three of them. Okay, you're going to get attacked by some street thugs. Or you're going to have some drugged out crazy people that bust into your home. And they want to just wreak whatever havoc they can because they're all strung out on drugs and they're desperate. And when people get desperate, they do desperate things. And sometimes it includes violence. Would you agree? That's what's more probable. So what are you preparing for? You know, you see a lot of these people that really invest a lot of time and money and having the most tactical, cool stuff and having all this extra gazillion round magazines, and they bolt all this junk to their AR-15s, and you know, and they've got these tactical rigs that are all ready to go, and it's like they're going to go fight. It's like they're going to go fight a war. And that's all fine and dandy, but I think a lot of people are fantasizing with that stuff. Is it possible? Yeah. I'd be lying if I said it wasn't possible. But is it probable? I'm assuming that most of you listening to this show are civilians. I know I have a lot of law enforcement that listen to this show. I have military people that listen to this show. Thank you, and thank you all for your service. People from other countries are listening to this show because I get emails from them. And I assume that most of you are kind of like me, everyday people just trying to live an everyday life, but you take seriously your self-defense needs, and you believe in providing for your own self-defense because you can't trust anybody else to do it for you and do it adequately and do it quickly. So what's probable? Now, Here's where I'm going with all this. What are you carrying? I keep it pretty simple. And I believe in simplicity. And one of the reasons I believe in simplicity is because when the stink hits the fan, when it really gets, you know, when it gets to the point where you got to draw your gun, you're having a really, really bad day. And you're going to be under, most likely, a tremendous amount of stress. And the simpler, the better. And the more tactical stuff you have sometimes complicates things. It's why I believe in simple handguns. It's why I believe in training for realistic civilian scenarios. It's why I believe in doing things like carrying an extra magazine, but it doesn't mean you have to have five magazines and be all tacticooled out. Okay, I keep my rifles simple. I keep my ARs very, very simple. I have one of them with iron sights. I have one of them with a red dot optic. And that's all. And I use good magazines. And I got a light. And pretty much that's simple stuff. You know, keep your holsters simple. You know, get a good Concealment Solutions Black Mamba. Get a good holster like that. You know, get a Dale Fricke Archangel holster if you like appendix carrying. And speaking of appendix carrying, Jason Christensen is sending me his new... he's sending me two of his new appendix carry rigs. He says he's got a new ASP coming out, appendix-specific platform. And I'm paying for him. I told him, I said, you know, I don't expect anything for free. And I'm going to get one for my Smith & Wesson Shield, MP Shield, and one for my Glock 42, and check it out. And an appendix carry in his new rig. But keeping it simple. You know, what about dressing? What about, you know, your wardrobe? You've heard me say many times, hey, I'm a business guy. You know, first and foremost, I love my full-time job. I really love what I do. And I'm getting pretty good at it. Had some really good months, by the way. Whew. Man, my commission checks the last couple months have made me smile because I've been working my tail off. And I love what I do. I could never see myself doing anything else other than being a salesperson. I love it. I've been doing it since I was 25 years old. And I tell you what, I like it. I've fallen in love with it. So I've been retired since I was 25 years old. Huh? What, Bob? What do you mean you've been retired? Well, let me tell you what I think work is, okay? Work versus retirement. I'll get off on a little bit of a tangent. Work is something you're doing when you'd probably like to do something else. Okay? Retirement's when you're doing what you love and you enjoy, and it doesn't seem like work. So, I like this. It doesn't seem like work. It's a lot of fun to me. So, since I was 25, I've been just having a blast. Okay, but I'm in business, so sometimes I cannot be tactical. Okay, sometimes I have to downsize my gun. Sometimes I cannot dress around my gun. You hear that all the time, right? Hey, dress around your gun. And sometimes I can't. I can't dress around my gun. The situation I'm in and the clients I'm going to see, it just won't allow me. I look like a fool if I'm in the room making a presentation and I've dressed around a big pistol. And everybody else is dressed differently. See, I believe in trying to mimic the dress style of my customers. That's kind of a sales 101 technique, is because people tend to warm up to other people that are like them. Know what I mean? And so I don't want to be too different than my customers. So sometimes I have to downsize my gun. So, you know, I read a lot of this, you know, these keyboard warriors on the internet. Saying, oh, dress around your gun. You can't always do that in some professions. Some of you listening to this podcast, I don't know what you do for a living, but I'll bet that there's some of you out there that are like me, and you have wardrobe restrictions. Am I right? And so you have to make a decision sometimes to simplify things. So, what's possible and what's probable? Well, do you have to have a full-size 1911 with five magazines? Because it's possible that you might need all of those 40 rounds or so. or almost 50 rounds, you might need that to get rid of a bad guy. Well, that's possible, but is that really probable? 50 rounds? Come on. Okay, it's funny. People say I carry a Glock 17 and three extra 17 round magazines. Okay, well, good. Is it possible you're going to need all that ammunition? Yeah. Is it probable? I think the probability is extremely low. And then what happens is some people get real frustrated because they can't consistently carry all that stuff all the time. I believe in consistency. What is it that you can consistently carry? Because I believe that a handgun, a defensive handgun, is no good to you unless you have it with you when the time comes that you need it. Rule number one of a gunfight, have a gun. And very few people have the ability to carry a full-size M&P 9mm, for example, or a full-size XD service pistol and three extra magazines around them all the time, and then wear one of those tactical fishing vests. Right? They all look like fishing vests. They do. I mean, no matter what concealed carry vest you buy, some of you guys that wear vests, I've seen you. And you wear them out in public, and it's okay. It's all right if you can get away with doing that. Most of the time, I can't. Okay? Most of the time, I can't get away with wearing one of those concealed carry vests. Looks like you're going bass fishing. So, am I going to always carry my Glock 19 with three extra magazines? No. And is it possible that I might need that? Well, yeah, but is it probable? I don't think so. Okay, I'm not saying don't carry an extra magazine. I believe in carrying an extra magazine for malfunction purposes, mostly. See, and by the way, you know what probably the least likely thing is you're going to have to do in a gunfight? The least likely thing is you're probably going to have to reload. That's the least likely thing. I'll borrow this from John Payne. John Payne at Suarez International taught me this. John Payne says, he asks the question, what is the least used item on a cop's belt? I'll say that again. What is the least used item on a police officer's belt? Spare magazines. Very seldom will a reload be necessary unless you have a really nasty malfunction early on in the gunfight that you can't clear. And you've got to get rid of that magazine because it might be a magazine-related issue. But if you've got a good quality handgun and you've practiced with it and you've trained with it and you've verified that it is reliable and you use good quality magazines, you use good quality ammunition, today's modern guns are pretty trouble-free. So, folks, get practical is what I'm saying. Get practical. Prepare more for the probable than for the possible. And when I say that, I also mean get good training. Get good practical training. Why spend a bunch of money on tactical stuff, really expensive, super tactical stuff, that it's possible you might need it, but not very probable? Why do that than to get some good training and train you in the probable situations that you might find yourself in should you have to use your handgun? Isn't that more valuable? At the end of the day, what's more valuable to you in saving your life? This is about saving your life, right? At the end of the day, what's more valuable? You walking home from a violent encounter and being able to go back to your family? Or all the tactical stuff you bought because, well, I can fight some zombies with this stuff. Yeah, you can. Is that possible remotely? But unfortunately, you didn't prepare enough for the everyday probable. And that's my everyday guy's look at this. And I'm sorry if you tuned into this podcast and you wanted to hear a tactical podcast and all technical and all that stuff. I'm going to tell you, my show is not for you because I just, I come at this from an everyday guy's perspective and I like to keep things practical. Okay, that's how I wanted to open up the show. A quick break and then I'll be back for the next segment.
An Australian law enforcement officer called their gun registration, quote, an elaborate system of arithmetic with no tangible aim. They also called its crime control use a fallacy. New Zealand police call their gun registration system useless. Canadian registration has cost 1,600% more than originally projected, and a top Canadian cop said it does nothing to take one illegal gun off the street. And in Germany, some people estimate that upwards of 80% of all guns there are still not registered. So why do some senators, and some presidents for that matter, think that it will work in America? Arm yourself with facts to strip the gun control industry bare. Visit gunfacts.info and get your free copy of Gun Facts. Called Indispensable by Cam Edwards of NRA News, Gun Facts is your rapid reference guide to debunking gun control myths and shaming politicians into obedience. www.gunfacts.info.
Okay, in this segment, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about reloaded ammunition again. Now, the reason I want to do this is because, you know, last week, Mark and Joe gave us a great episode on reloading ammunition. And there was a point in that interview where they discussed the fact that it's probably a pretty good idea to stay away from using reloaded ammunition for self-defense purposes. Now, this is kind of a hotly contested subject. I mean, hey, after all, that's I like this kind of stuff, right? I like hotly contested arguments. I love that. That's what this show is all about. I like to get people thinking. And I tend to cover some pretty controversial stuff on this podcast just because I have fun with it. But this subject here about using reloaded ammunition seems to cause a lot of arguments. And, you know, there's a lot of internet commandos. I've talked about them. And they like to get on forums, and I call them keyboard warriors. They like to get on forums and put stuff out there, and they don't necessarily know what they're talking about or have a whole lot of experience in their subject matter. You know, I mean, I don't know if you know this or not. This could be a surprise to you, but not everything that you read on the internet is true, especially in gun forums, right? Well, let's talk a little bit about reloading or using reloads for self-defense. Why most people believe that it's pretty much a no-no. First, I'm going to point to Masad Ayoub. Now, I'm going to put a couple of references in the show notes for this episode. I'm going to put links to articles in the show notes of this episode. So you can read all these, and I'm just going to paraphrase them. You can read them in detail. But a listener of mine on Facebook, after he heard last week's show, he asked if I could come up with some cases, some actual court cases, where using reloads made a difference. And yes, I've come up with a couple. These are from Masad Ayoub. Masad Ayoub was involved in these cases, or he was at least involved in doing a lot of research in these cases. But so, you know, Masad Ayoub is obviously one of the very obviously best experts on the legalities of self-defense. I've been to that course twice. I've been to MAG 40 twice. Most of you know the first time I went as a student. The second time I helped instruct on the line during the shooting portion and also sat through quite a bit of the class again, which is great. If you ever get a chance to repeat that class, by the way, you need to repeat it because it's that good. So I will get into a couple cases from Masad Ayoub. But here's kind of one theory that maybe you haven't thought about. I didn't think about this until I started researching this subject for you. When looking at reloads, one of the factors when your case is investigated is what's called gunshot residue. Now, I don't know if you've thought about this before, but here's where using hand-loaded ammunition can be somewhat problematic. First of all, think about this. If you're in a shooting, every single aspect of your case is going to be investigated and investigated thoroughly. You're a fool if you don't think so. And everything that can be done will be done to pick you apart. everything is going to be analyzed. Because you're going to have your side, you're going to have a defense attorney that is going to be trying to get you acquitted, because you're going to get charged with a crime, folks. Even if it's a legitimate self-defense shooting, you're going to get charged with a crime. That's why you need organizations like Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network, and why you also need Texas Law Shield and other folks like that. And speaking of Texas Law Shield, I'm going to have Michelle, one of their attorneys, address this subject probably next week. So I'm probably going to get Michelle from Texas Law Shield to address this subject again next week. She's a self-defense attorney. But everything is going to get picked apart. Everything that you did in that case, even if it was legitimate self-defense, is likely to get picked apart. So here's why it's problematic to use hand loads. And of course, this is what Masada Yub says. I didn't make this stuff up. But one of the things he points out is a defensive shooting is usually very close range. It's a very close range affair. I've talked about that many times. Okay? So the gunshot residue from your muzzle, it's going to end up somewhere on the bad guy's body or his clothes. And this can be critical evidence. Here's an example. If the bad guy's side, and yes, the bad guy, whether he's dead or not, is going to get represented. Okay, his family may take you to court. The bad guy's side might insist that, well, you know, you shouldn't have shot him because he was too far away from you to be in any danger. At the moment you shot him, he was way too far away, and there's no way that your life could have been in danger. So it was not a justifiable shooting. So what they've done there is they've injected distance as the evidence factor. And they're saying that you, the good guy, should not have shot him, the bad guy, because he wasn't close enough to pose any major threat to you. Got it? Are you with me so far? So when the distance testing is done, and distance testing is going to be done by the crime labs, they're going to use ammunition that is identical to what was in your gun. Now think about that. If they're going to distance test, in other words, if they're going to test the gunshot residue, and they're going to do a distance test to try to duplicate what distance did this happen at, they're going to use the same kind of ammunition that's in your gun. Well, wait a minute. You hand-loaded your ammo. Well, how can you be sure, as good as you might be at reloading ammunition, how can you be sure that all of the rounds that you had in your magazine at that time were identically loaded? They had the same amount of powder in them. See where I'm going with this? It's a lot easier to duplicate it with factory ammo. I mean, if you used federal HSTs, for example, let's say you're shooting a 9mm, and you used federal HST 127 grain plus P. When they do the testing, they could probably go buy a box of federal 127 grain plus P HSTs, and they could probably do gunshot residue testing on those, and they're all going to be consistent. Or extremely consistent. So that when they try to figure out what was the distance that this crime was committed at, the gunpowder residue or the gunshot residue is going to be pretty much the same from that same box of factory ammo. But if it's your reloads, how are they going to duplicate that? Think about that. How are they going to duplicate your reloads? Because you loaded them. Think about that. And another interesting point here that Masada Ayub points out, he said that no one has yet been able to offer a case where the court took a reloader's data or took his word for what was actually in the load. Okay? I mean, if you think about that, no one's been able to show a case yet where the court took the reloader's data or took his word and said, oh yeah, well, you know, that's how I loaded my ammo. How are they going to really take your word for that? But if it's a large ammo company like Federal, Winchester, Corban, Speer, if it's large ammo companies like that, it's much more difficult. I'm not saying impossible, but it's much more difficult for them to refute a large ammo company's word as to what exactly is loaded in that ammunition, because it's far more consistent. Plus, these are large ammo companies. Okay, it's a little harder to dispute what large ammo companies say than what you, the reloader, says. It's kind of like, you know, David and Goliath. Oh, well, that's a bad example because David killed Goliath, okay? So, scratch that. But it's kind of like, okay, you got this big ammo company. You got this big multi-million dollar, possibly billion dollar ammunition company. And this is what they do. They make ammunition. And they know best what's in their ammunition. And they know how it's loaded. And they know how everything is put in those cases. They know exactly how the gunpowder is put in there. They know exactly how the rounds are put in there, how the bullets are put in, what kind of primers and everything. It's all consistent. And they can show tons and tons and tons of evidence that their ammo is consistent. And then in walks you into the courtroom. Just you. And you're going to expect a jury who probably they're not gun people. Okay, keep in mind, the jury's probably not going to be gun people, all right? I mean, this notion that we get a jury of our peers, baloney. If I'm in a shooting, and they're going to give me a jury of my peers, they better have some good shooters on that jury. They better have some people that took some training, or some IDPA shooters, or some gun people. So they're not going to be a jury of your peers. And you expect them to believe that you're just as consistent at reloading your ammunition as, say, Federal or Winchester or Corbon or Speer and companies like that. Okay, I'm just saying that you need to think about every angle that could be used against you. You know, could this sink your case all by itself? Maybe not. It might not be the only thing that sinks your case, that throws you in jail because you used reloaded ammunition. But why take the chance, folks? And I got more coming up from Masada Yu because there's a couple cases I want to talk about. But I want to ask you a question. Why take the chance? There's so much good factory ammunition out there. Oh, but it's $1.25 a round, Bob. It's $1.25 a round. I could save a lot of money by reloading. Save money reloading for practice and for training. But how much is your life worth, folks? Come on. Is your life worth $1.25 a round? Mine is. So just because the ammo's expensive, you know, don't take a chance with your self-defense. Buy good quality ammunition. Here's something else to think about when buying good quality ammunition for self-defense. Here's another reason to maybe think about not loading or not carrying reloaded ammunition for self-defense purposes. And again, I'm not against reloading, folks. I don't reload, but it's not because I'm against it. I'm kind of jealous of reloaders because they do save money or they do shoot more, like Mark and Joe mentioned last week. So I'm not against it. But here's something to think about. I've taught quite a few training classes. I've also been to a lot of competition matches. And I've seen a lot of malfunctions, and I've seen a lot of malfunctions due to ammunition. Guess what? Most of the ammunition-related malfunctions that I see are because of someone's reloads, because they made some mistakes reloading their ammo. I've seen a guy blow up his gun because he made a mistake in loading his ammo. Now, when Mark and Joe were talking about reloading last week, they admitted they made mistakes. Why would you want to increase the amount of potential malfunctions in a self-defense situation? Think about that. How many of you would agree right now listening to this that reliability is huge? Reliability is a huge factor. You want that gun to go bang. You wanted to get rid of that bad guy and do it right now without fail. And if you have to fire a second, third, fourth, eighth, or tenth shot, you want it to be reliable, don't you? Again, in the training classes that I've been fortunate enough to teach, I have seen malfunctions with reloaded ammunition. That's great for the range. It gives you good malfunction practice. It gives you great malfunction clearing practice. So that's fine. And out at the range, last time I checked, those targets are not shooting back. So have at it. Use all kinds of hand loads. Practice clearing your malfunctions. Learn from your mistakes. Reload your ammo differently so that it's a little bit more reliable. But why? Why would you want to use ammunition that has a greater likelihood of causing your gun to malfunction? I got to tell you, I've run a lot of self-defense loads through all my guns, my Glocks, and my 1911s, M&P, everything. I've run a lot of self-defense ammunition through them. And I can't remember the last time that I had an ammunition-related malfunction. As a matter of fact, I can't remember the last time I had a malfunction with self-defense ammunition. Now, you might be saying, well, Bob, that's not a fair example because you run thousands and thousands of rounds every year of FMJ practice ammo, and you don't run thousands and thousands of rounds of self-defense ammo through your guns. Well, you'd be right. But the quality control that companies like Federal and Winchester and Corban and Speer and many of the others out there, the quality control that they put into their self-defense ammunition is pretty good, especially the very good manufacturers. Double Tap Ammo does a great job too with their quality control. Great stuff. I highly recommend Double Tap Ammo as well. So think about it from a malfunction standpoint. I don't know if you've ever given that much thought when you think about, well, gee, should I use hand-loaded ammunition for self-defense purposes? You're not perfect. I know you might like to think you are, but how many of us really are perfect? And how many of us are really going to perfectly load every piece or every round of ammunition perfectly loaded at the same time, every time, as compared to the large ammunition companies who do it for a living? Okay, now, I promised a couple of court cases. And again, these were posted by Masad Ayoub, and they were posted on, one of them was on gunforums.net. No, it was at the High Road. That was where it was posted on the forum, the High Road. And again, I'll put a link where you can look this up. But Iowa versus Corporal Randy Willems. Iowa versus Corporal Randy Willems. Now, Corporal Willems was a Davenport, Iowa cop. Okay, and a guy tried to disarm him and murder him. And basically the guy was like, you know, give me your blankety blank gun or I'm going to blow your blankety blank brains out. And Corporal Willems shot him during the disarming attempt. And it dropped him instantly with one hit to the abdomen from a department-issued factory round, which was Fiocchi 9mm, 115 grain jacketed hollow point, plus P+. Now, the guy survived, but he stated that the officer had shot him for nothing, and that he was a substantial distance away. Again, here's that distance. Here's that distance factor. Well, gunshot residue testing showed conclusively that the subject's torso was about 18 inches from the muzzle of the Beretta 92 when it was discharged. So Corporal Randy Willems was acquitted of criminal charges in that trial. Okay, so here they were able to prove, that the guy was about 18 inches away. When here the guy was trying to say, oh, the cop shot me for nothing. I was way too far away. Because he was using factory ammo. Fiocchi 9mm, 115 grain, jacketed hollow point, plus P+. And Mass says that he likes to cite this case specifically because it's a great example of how they can replicate factory ammo when they do the forensic evidence testing. And they can annihilate false allegations by the bad guy. Okay? So again, because it was factory loaded ammunition, they were able to easily replicate the gunshot residue and replicate the ballistics of the factory ammo. So it just totally destroys the allegations of the bad guy, saying, well, he was too far away from me. Now, if Corporal Willems would have been using reloaded ammunition, then it might have been a lot harder to defeat the bad guy's case. So think about that. That's, you know, again, I don't know if these are things that you guys typically think of or not, for those of you who do think about using reloaded ammunition or hand-loaded ammunition for self-defense. I mean, have you ever given some of this stuff some thought? Because, again, your case is going to get picked apart like crazy. And I think you're a fool if you think it's not going to. And you might be saying, well, if it's a justified shoot, I'm going to be okay. Not necessarily. Not necessarily. Especially, it depends on where you live. You know, are you in an anti-gun place or are you in a gun-friendly place? And just because you live in a gun-friendly place doesn't mean they're going to just, you know, wash their hands and say, hey, good job there, sir. Way to go. No, there's still people that are going to be suing you and trying to sue the pants off you, both civilly and criminally. It might help that you're in a gun-friendly place. But it's not a slam dunk that you're going to be acquitted just because you're in a gun-friendly place. Now, here's another case I want to talk about that Mass brings up. New Hampshire versus Kennedy. James Kennedy was a sergeant in New Hampshire on a police force, and he was going after a drunk driver who was being real reckless. And they ended up in the ditch. The suspect ended up in the ditch anyway, stalled. And so James Kennedy, the sergeant, approached the vehicle, and when he got to the driver's door, the guy in the car grabbed his .45, pulled it towards him, and it discharged in his face. Now, the reload in the gun was a 200-grain spear jacketed hollow point loaded to duplicate the 1,000 feet per second from a 5-inch barrel that was advertised by Spear. Now, Mass says this is the first time he saw the argument that was made, why wasn't regular ammunition deadly enough for you? And that was used by the opposing counsel. So they charged Officer Kennedy with aggravated assault, and they made a large issue out of his use of hand loads, suggesting that he was kind of being a reckless guy, and he was out to cause maximum damage. Now, the result here was Mass recommended that they hire Jim Cirillo, and Jim Cirillo did a great job of demolishing the argument and the other bogus claims against the Kennedy, and eventually he was acquitted. Now, it had a good outcome. But again, using hand loads complicates the matter. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have a good outcome, and it complicates the matter. Furthermore, they can also use the argument against you, well, guess what? You're a killer. You carry a gun and you go around trying to be a killer because you load these high-powered bullets that are meant to kill and maim people. You do it on purpose, and that's what you put in your gun. And that's an argument that can easily be made by the opposing lawyers. So again, I go back to asking the question, why do you want to give them that opportunity? Why do you want to open up that can of worms? Is it really worth it? You know, when I was asked this question about some cases that were brought up, or some case law, I did some research and I wanted to answer the listener's question. And so I urge him and everybody else to look at the two links. There might be two or three links that I put in the show notes, where you can actually read some of these cases. There's one involving suicide. There's one case involving suicide that actually, if it hadn't have been for hand loads, it probably would have gotten solved a lot sooner. It was one that got very, very, very complicated and wasn't necessarily a really good ending, all because of hand-loaded ammunition. And you can look that one up in the link that I put. It's New Jersey versus Bias. So check that one out, New Jersey versus Bias, and you'll see that in the show notes. So folks, my recommendation, use factory ammunition, and by the way, don't you want to know that your defensive ammo is going to be consistent every time? So again, nothing against reloading. I'm not saying you shouldn't hand load your ammunition. I need to do it. I need to hand load one of these days. I need to get into it, buy some equipment, just get started slow, just real simple, and start doing it just for the sake of doing it. Even if I don't save any money, or even if it doesn't make me go out and shoot anymore, at least I can start learning the process. And Mark and Joe last week did a real good job of getting me interested in doing it. So, anyway, I'll have more on that later. Okay, just a quick sound effect or some kind of an announcement or something like that, maybe some music, whatever, and I'll get on to the next segment.
Good afternoon. This is your captain speaking with just a little flight information. Coming up on the left, we're going to be catching a glimpse of the Grand Canyon. On the right, you can be able to see the Hoover Dam in just a few minutes. We're flying at an altitude of 37,000 feet, and our airspeed is 400 miles an hour. Couple little facts here. I'm packing a Colt King Cobra. That's a 357 caliber firearm with a black rubber grip and a 6-inch barrel. Also, the co-pilot is carrying a Kimber custom defense pistol with all the bells and whistles you'd expect from a custom gun of that kind, with an alloy frame and bevel treatment on the entire gun. And our chief flight attendant, Roger, has a Ruger Bearcat 22 with a hand-fluted cylinder. All three are capable of piercing body armor at a distance of up to 27 feet, and it can put a hole in human bone and flesh the size of the Grand Canyon, which, by the way, is coming up on the left-hand side of the plane, so just sit back and relax and enjoy the rest of the flight.
Okay, in this segment, I was going to have an interview, but I think that pretty much does it for this episode. I've covered two real good topics, and I think I've given you guys some things to think about and hopefully some good information. So, I do have two interviews coming up next week. I'm going to have two special guests. I'm actually going to be doing the interviews shortly after I upload this podcast for you to listen to. So they will be next week. I'm going to have Michelle from Texas Law Shield talking about some, well, I'm going to leave that as a surprise, but she is going to talk about some legal stuff. Michelle's an attorney. She's a self-defense attorney with Texas Law Shield. She's going to be talking about some legal stuff regarding carrying a gun. And then I'm also going to have Scott from California. He's an instructor out there. I'm going to ask him what it's like to be a California instructor and so forth, and we'll go from there. So, thanks for listening to another episode of the Handgun World podcast. I'm Bob Main. I'm your host. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. Remember that the loudest sound that a shooter hears is a bang when he's expecting a click, or a click when he's expecting a bang. Shoot straight, shoot safe. Talk to you next week. Goodbye.